close pretty nicely here at mid-session, there's a chance this may happen as we close out the day. As for the corn complex, little doubt that the wheat strength has helped this complex a lot today, as has the boll spreading being seen here at mid-session. We suspect wheat bolls are moving over into the corn today, and we expect that short-term technicians are buying the corn here, since the shorter-term charts look fairly constructive. 405 and three quarters is last week's close in March futures. A move back above this could spur yet more buying in our view as we head into the final bell. From Risk Management Commodities here in Lafayette, Indiana, have a great weekend, everybody.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff of The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring free performances by the U of I Black Chorus, Nathaniel Banks and Friends, the U of I Latin Jazz Band, and Tonic Sofa in 2008. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
It's 7 minutes past one now on the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jay Pierce, in for Celeste Quinn. We wish her speedy recovery. And now an archived interview that Celeste conducted with journalist Jonathan Englert about The Collar, A Year of Striving and Faith Inside a Catholic Seminary. And because this is recorded, although you'll hear phone calls being taken during the program, please no calls today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. The Catholic Church in the U.S. has seen a dramatic reduction in the number of priests over the last several decades. The number of Catholics has grown by 40% over the last 30 years to 64 million. The number of priests has decreased by 25%. Why? What motivates men to enter the priesthood? We'll take a look at those questions this afternoon with our guest journalist, Jonathan Englert. He spent more than a year following five seminarians through their daily lives. These seminarians came to study for the priesthood later in life. They are known as second career priests. Englert is the author of The Collar, A Year of Striving and Faith Inside a Catholic Seminary. Jonathan Englert is a graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism. He also attended the Fordham University School of Law. His work has appeared in publications including the New York Times and Catholic Digest. He became a practicing Catholic as an adult. His book, The Collar, published by Houghton Mifflin. Jonathan Englert, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much, Celeste.
A couple of related questions, and I suppose obvious questions here at the top. What inspired you to write this book, and what led you to your interest in how men prepare for the priesthood?
Well, it's a good question. I was determined to write this book, at least in part, for a strong journalistic reason. Nicholas Lemon, who is the current dean of Columbia J School, has a saying that it was very instructive, and that was that 99% of the journalists cover 1% of the story, which leaves the other 1% of the journalists to cover kind of the 99% of the other stories, the stories that don't get told, or the other side of the story. And I felt that the priesthood and then, of course, seminary formation wasn't really being covered in the mass media as well or as in depth or even maybe as balanced as it could have been. And that was sort of one of the driving forces. I just thought the story really wasn't being told.
Yeah. And I suppose the 1% of this story that has been told, you know, is largely the sex abuse scandals. That is when we think of the church and the priesthood at this moment in time, that jumps to mind.
Right, and that in no way, writing this book in no way de-emphasizes, I suppose, the horrific reality of that story.
Yeah.
And of course, that figures as a backdrop to in the seminary. It colors so much of, I think, it was such a horrific reality that the entire, it raises so many, questions, and it was just, the damage is still, carrying down today, to today.
Yeah. And this presented a challenge for you as you set out to do the reporting for this book. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it certainly did. Access was crucial to the writing of this book. I realized that if I wanted to answer the questions, why would someone become a priest today? And how would they go about doing that? In other words, what was the method through which someone becomes a priest? Goes from sort of civilian life into priesthood. I knew that I'd need complete access to a seminary to do that, and complete access to seminarians. And seminaries you wouldn't immediately think that they'd be easy places to just sort of walk into and start, take out your notepad and start writing. They're not. I had access originally to two seminaries, and lost that access, which was a difficult thing to go through. As I said, I really need to get inside to tell the full story. And I eventually found a seminary called Sacred Heart School of Theology in Hales Corners, Wisconsin. I live in New York, and this was going to be it seemed like it was going to be a big logistical hurdle, But in the end, it was terrific. I flew out there for a first meeting with the rector. The rector is the head of the seminary. And I explained, I said, look, I really need complete access. Please let me know if you can do that, because I don't want partial access. I can't write this story if I have partial access. And in all credit to him, he understood what I wanted to get at. And he said, fine, we'll open up our institution to you. And again, in credit to them, nobody was ever hanging over my shoulder looking at what I was writing. Nobody was ever telling me, talk to this person, but don't talk to that person. And the result was The Collar, a sort of a book that covers a lot of different bases. It goes right in and is a fly on the wall perspective into seminary life today.
Hmm. The rector, Father Jim Bracken.
That's right. Yeah.
And the other men of Sacred Heart. How have they received the book now that it's out? Have they read it? And
Father Bracken is no longer the rector of the seminary. He's moved on to another ministry. I believe he read it and enjoyed it. I've gotten some very favorable responses from the seminarians and from some of the priests and the people who are on the faculty. Because as it covers everything. It covers the faculty, teaching scripture and theology. Everything, philosophy, and then it covers the formation, the spiritual formation, so the priests and the lay people who work to kind of ready these men for the demands of the priesthood spiritually. Across the board, I've gotten a sense that I think in some respects there are things that, I guess, if you looked at it from a PR perspective, anybody would say, "Oh, I wish that wasn't in there," if you were at the seminary. But the overall perspective response has been, "You were fair. You really told you captured what this is all about, what we're all about." So I, that was a gratifying thing to hear.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about one of the big questions here. Why has the number of priests declined so precipitously?
That is a big question. It's one probably beyond my power to illuminate too much. The Collar isn't a study. It's not an analysis, what have you. However, in writing it and in spending 5 years doing this, I do have some kind of preliminary conclusions, I guess, some preliminary answers to that question. That one of which is that culturally we've changed quite a bit. I think it used to be that you'd have large Catholic families, and there was almost a sense that one of the brood, as it were, would be going into religious life. And I think that has disappeared. So you don't have that anymore, at least not probably to the same degree. The other thing, though, I think, which is a bigger, much bigger contribution, is simply the way we live now. I wanted to write the book in part to capture the sense that one of the things that inspired me was that this is a radical choice you make to become a priest. It's a radical and a countercultural one. And it's countercultural, I think, far beyond the celibacy issue, which, of course, is the one that is the sort of hot-button issue that you hear, you know, all the time. It goes into the obedience question, which that's by far the bigger issue. That these guys are coming from a society where we can kind of create our own little bubbles. We live in our own little bubbles in a way, you know, our kind of our own spheres, and we can sort of live maybe the way we want to. A lot of things are within our control. Of course, many things aren't, but a lot of things are. And we maybe also have a sense that, well, we can serve in a lot of different ways if that's what we're going to do. And becoming a priest is giving up a lot of stuff. I mean, these men, for example, you mentioned it's a second career seminary, and that indeed is true, although the men are a cross-section. Two of the guys I followed were in their 30s. But all of them gave up, you know, oftentimes jobs, their own apartments or homes, you know, their cars. Well, not so much their cars, but I mean, basically a lot of the accoutrement of sort of modern life, and to move into rooms that were just had recently been converted from phone booths, and to eat in at a dining hall, you know, and have to appear at certain times for classes and prayer and be evaluated on all this. It's a very different, and know also beyond all that that they're going to be joining a life in which this is the rest of their life. The rest of their life is going to be, to some extent, scrutinized, and not their own. You know, one of service to people. Sometimes maybe they don't agree with it, and this is a kind of radical shift for a lot of people today.
Yeah. So why would anyone want to do it?
Why would anyone? And that's a million-dollar question. I mean, I think there, I think at the heart of it is really a mystery. It still to a great extent remains a mystery to me. I mean, I spent a lot of time with five men. They're the central kind of characters of the book, and then of course, additionally, with a lot of other people,
mm-hmm.
and. There were some themes that kept coming forward. For example, there was a sort of a personal vision of priesthood that most of the men had, a sense that, for example, some of them, when they were young, had a vision of themselves saying Mass. You know, and this is something that sort of haunted them for years, sometimes through marriages and through their own marriages. And their life, and then it stayed there, sort of haunting them. So in a way, this vocation, this calling, was a kind of haunting. That's one element of the mystery. Another one, and maybe more practical level, was that, for example, one of the men was 68 when he entered. He'd been married for 45 years, had raised four children, had three grandchildren, had a successful business career, and. After his wife died of cancer, he nursed her through cancer. They were very, very close. He reexamined his life, and he really looked at what he was going to do with the rest of his life. And he knew he had a lot of energy. He knew he had a lot that he could give. He had also been in minor seminary when he was a teenager, and in fact, he'd left seminary in part because of meeting his wife or future wife. In any case, the practical level was he thought, well, this is something I can bring a lot to. This is something I can give a lot to, and I can commit myself to. So there was a more practical, sort of service aspect to his decision. Although he had the mystery was also there, but so I think that at least that might be part of the answer to this question.
Yeah. Well, here's another way of looking at the question, perhaps. What are the rewards of priesthood?
Wow. Well, that's you're sort of getting this is the nitty gritty, I guess, of this journey for these guys. The rewards, to some extent, are quite internal. I think it's a sense if the priesthood for the person is a vocation, in other words, this calling, and they answer that call, then part of the reward. Is the fact that they simply answered the call, that they are doing exactly what they are meant to be doing at this time. You know, you hear a lot of people talk, you know, sort of a sense of restlessness. Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my life? These men, usually when they had reached ordination, they were very confident that they were doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing with their lives at that moment. And so that is actually quite a significant reward, at least through in their eyes. And I think the other thing is that many of these people they want to serve people, and the reward then comes also from this like daily act of being involved with people's lives and helping them out, and the gratification that comes from that. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of strain struggle that can come from having to, say, be the one priest in a parish of 4,000 families with all those demands on you. But there's also a lot of gratification for the person who likes to be there for people.
Yeah. As I mentioned in my introduction, you came to the faith as an adult. What led you to become a practicing Catholic, and has that provided you with insight into the draw, the calling of a priest?
Yeah, you know, that's I did come to become a Catholic as an adult. It's probably the subject of a whole other book if I ever get around to writing it, because it was quite a sort of long, drawn out, but also in a way dramatic conversion experience. I would say with respect to writing this book that what it gave me was the empathy and the vocabulary, the religious or the spiritual vocabulary, to understand and, in fact, connect with the men that I was following and other people at the seminary. It gave me the ability to, win confidence, because I knew I could understand where they were coming from, could speak at a certain level. Which was crucial, because so much of the book goes inside the heads of these guys. So there would, and that's all reliant on a heavy repertorial method, you know, heavy journalistic method, where you're just talking and talking and talking to people over a long period of time. And it was very important that I had that empathy and that vocabulary. I'd read somewhere that someone said that the book couldn't be objective because I was a Catholic, and I found that in a way somewhat understandable, but not really, because it's as if like objectivity rests in the method. It seems to me that it's the method that keeps you honest. You know, I wasn't out to write an apologetic of the church or write a defense. I simply wanted to tell a story, and that meant that whatever came into sort of view, whether it was, say, objectively, I guess, negative or positive, whatever those terms mean, that it was going to make it, into the book, because I had to tell the full story going in. So, yeah.
The seminarians that you profile in the book, The Collar, are Rob Kinzierski.
Ron, excuse me. And his name, I believe it's Ron Kinzierski. I've struggled with the pronunciation as well. So.
Ron, yeah. And then Dean Haley.
Right.
Jim Heiser, Jim Pemberton, and Don Malin.
That's right, yeah.
So tell us about them. What had they done? You talked a little bit about a couple of them now, but what had they done with their lives prior to Sacred Heart?
Well, they're all very interesting people. I chose them because I was writing. You know, the book happens within the span of a year, and yet seminary education, or the formation process, takes about 5 years. Usually about 5 years for it to be complete. So I needed to give it a sense of both a cross section of different types of people, but also a sense of how that process plays out over the long haul. So maybe I'll go with Don and start back where Don was. He's in his final year. And for him, a lot of the big issues, the struggles have kind of come together. And he's right there ready for ordination. And he's a man who had been married for 12 years. He went through a very difficult divorce. He had also toyed with a vocation, maybe more than toyed with it, years before he had even been married. And so for him, he was, after his divorce and after a number of years working in church environments and also teaching music, he was really an accomplished musician. He decided, you know, he finally decided, I think this is where I should be going. And he arrived at seminary not really feeling, in his own words, not really feeling that he had necessarily a vocation, more along the lines of, this is where there is need. There's a need for priests, and I'm a devout Catholic, and I know I can serve in this way. And by the end of the process, he really wants to be a priest as well, you know, and he's committed to it. Then there's Jim Pemberton. Jim Pemberton, I've already mentioned, was married for 45 years. He's widowed, has four children, three grandchildren. He was a marketing executive for I think it's Six Flags Corporation, the amusement park corporation, and he just has. There are a lot of interesting things about Jim Pemberton. One interesting story is that he had gone to seminary when he was 13. He had this calling to go to seminary, and his mother was Catholic, and his father was a Methodist jazz trumpet player. And his father, when he heard that his son wanted to go to seminary, he told the mother, "Well, I'm not going to object. I'm not going to fight this one, but I want another son." So Jim goes off to seminary, and 7 years later, he actually ends up leaving seminary to get married. Meanwhile, they've had a younger brother, and the younger brother ends up becoming a priest. So now there are two priests. You know, both brothers are now priests, and his younger brother's been a priest for 25 years. So he's going into it with kind of interesting perspective. I mean, he's very, as I said, though, he wants to serve, he wants to spend the rest of his life as a priest, you know, and he believes he can bring a lot to the table, certainly with respect to family struggles and that type of thing.
Mm.
Yeah. Then Jim Heiser is another important character. He is married, he was married and divorced. He raised his son on his own until he was about 21, and until his son was 21. And Heiser's he loves the outdoors. He's a hunter, but he's also sort of a conservationist hunter. I don't know, but he also has a great affinity for American Indian culture. His best friend is a Native American, and he's just a very colorful character. He brings all of that to the seminary and to his life there. And to his idea of vocation. And then the two characters who struggle the most would be Ron and Dean.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Haley's an ex-Marine. He's a younger man. He's about 30 when he arrives at the seminary. And he really struggles with what he finds there. He has ADHD. But his personality is such that he's very, very bright. He's a very bright guy, but he likes to make his own rules. And part of the seminary program is really you need to adapt to rules. You just have to, because you have to adapt to other people's timelines and other people's, because all of this is part of the formation of how are you, you know, how so much of what a priest does is kind of timelines and working within other people's schedules. And working within schedules, and Dean really struggles with this. He misses masses. He misses class. He sort of oversleeps a lot, and just doesn't really. And then he struggles with a lot of stuff that he's learning as well. So he's kind of an interesting set piece.
Yeah, and Ron.
And then Ron is also fascinating. He's blind. He's been blind since birth. That didn't prevent him from accomplishing some pretty amazing things. He has two master's degrees. He's an accomplished violinist, and he arrives at seminary, and he likewise struggles, I think, on a lot of grounds. First, he has problems with a lot of the dogmatic part of teachings of the church, and that of course is pretty difficult for a priest who's supposed to be reflecting those and defending them, and he struggles a lot with that internally. And he also really doesn't know. I mean, a big thing for some of these men is that, wow, I'm going to be committing to, for the next 30 or 40 years to this institution. And what is this institution all about? Is it going to be there the same way for me 30 or 40 years from now? Is it solid? You know, and that goes right back to your initial question about the decline in the number of priests and the decline, which is going to probably affect the very nature, functioning nature of Catholicism in the U.S.
Yeah.
And around the world.
That's a question we'll come back to, I think, before the end of the interview. I have a couple of listeners who would like to talk with you.
Oh, great.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Jonathan Englert. He is the author of The Collar, A Year of Striving and Faith Inside a Catholic Seminary. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with the telephone call. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's go first to our toll-free line, a listener in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hello. Being non-Catholic, but lucky enough to have a close friend that was Catholic when I was growing up in grade school and all that sort of stuff, he was the oldest son, and he was picked to go to the seminary up in South Bend, actually. When I was down at IU, I walked into a snack bar, and there he was, and I was, you know, sort of dumbfounded, and he had been asked to leave because he, I guess, spent most of his time in pool holes and gambling and stuff. The second son was the one everybody in the community expected to go on to the priesthood, but unfortunately, I went to school and moved on and never found out what happened. But I remember he used to do things that made me query, you know, religion in general, but in Catholicism in general, too. And I was just wondering if you could turn this, if this is germane, if it's not, it doesn't make that much difference to me because you have the book to move. When the men go into the priesthood, I had a fellow told me, he says, well, hell, they just went in to do those children. They weren't really wanting to be priests at all. That was just, they saw an easy avenue. And I wonder if you could speak to that sort of thing. I would imagine there's some kind of oath you take, you know, and in the sense that standing before God and, you know, saying yes and no and certain things like that makes me question, you know, at least their sincerity. And I think this sort of thing would probably have an effect on the younger generation coming up, trying to decide whether they're going to get the call or not. That thing about getting the call, I find sometimes, questionable, to say the least. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Well, there's a lot there. I think I'll focus on what I think the core of your question is, and that is, because it just, something jumped out at me when we were talking, and that is, there is a big difference, I think, today in terms of the types of people who are coming to seminary. These guys don't, since there isn't that necessarily that cultural pressure, or certainly not the sense of esteem that priests in certain communities were once held in. In fact, it's almost counter. You almost have to. I mean, a number of the men had told me it was almost, when they'd mentioned they were going to become priests, people would say, "Well, why would you do that? You know, why would you do that today? I mean, it's like a step down. You know." In a lot of people's eyes. And I think, so the difference to some extent today is that a lot of these people are really making a very independent and a choice. I mean, I call the book The Collar because, you know, there's a sense of the Roman collar, obviously, but then they're being collared. They have a sense that this haunting of a vocation isn't going away and that they're being called to do this work and collared in a way, you know, made to do this work. But free will acts very strongly here. I mean, these guys are making a conscious choice to accept that call. In terms of the sincerity of the call, I'm in any field, any profession, you know, they're going to be varying degrees of sincerity. And unfortunately, as you pointed out, there can be people who, can make it all the way through and they have very, very, very wrong reasons for doing that. But I think the difference in today's seminary as opposed to the past is that most of the people there are there for maybe more independent reasons, as it were. free will. Thanks very much.
Let's talk with another listener. In Champaign, on line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just a couple of things. I think you touched on something. First of all, let me say I look forward to reading your book. But,
thanks.
I think one of the reasons priests, there aren't as many priests as before, is that the priest was held in a higher, and you touched on this, higher cultural position, and there's so many ways to have different careers today that I think the priesthood has somewhat fallen by the wayside.
Right.
And two, I have a question. I've read it repeatedly, both criticisms on the left and the right in terms of the church, that many seminaries are, many of the priests that go into the seminaries are homosexual, which I personally don't have a problem with as long as they maintain the vow of celibacy. But is that true? Is there really any truth to that? I'm thinking of Dr. Richard Sipes' book, I believe.
Yeah.
And I'll just hang up and listen, okay?
Yeah, oh, thank you. Yeah, that's, excuse me. As I said before, the caller wasn't an analysis or a study. I'm not familiar with the book that you cited, but I certainly am familiar with the general sort of tenor of the argument or the position, which is that a lot of seminaries have a large homosexual population. In the caller, and it might be a function in part because of the type of age range that I had in the book. A cross section.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of men had been married, and I don't know. The homosexuality issue, I have to say, was not a big issue in the seminary. It wasn't a big issue, and I think you touched upon this also. It went to the issue of celibacy, and the type of training that the men had to become adjusted to this notion of being celibate and serving. And then in turn went to the question of obedience. But I think that that's one of those areas where, as I referred to, what a lot of the media covers about priesthood and seminary life, I didn't really find that to be a huge issue in the seminary. I just didn't.
And next we talk with a listener on line two, also in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I just wonder whether a contributory factor in terms of the, going in the priesthood was that in high schools, Catholic high schools, there was a time that there were a lot of priests and brothers, or they might be all brothers. There's certainly been a decline, in terms of where students see priests. There might be a priest or so, but in terms of as educators.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting question because, one of the questions that I had for you, Jonathan, was, the decline in the number of priests, they're not as many, they're not, so we don't see them so much. And, how is this changing how American Catholics see their priests and is it changing how American Catholics practice their faith?
Well, I think there are two points there that I'd like to address, because it is a good question. There have been a number of studies that show that oftentimes a person's vocation is people go to seminary because they've been asked by another priest. They've been asked by a priest that they know and respect, who says, I think you'd make a good priest. So that the caller's question is or sort of observation is quite accurate in the sense that if you don't have a presence, a priestly presence, then that avenue for service, that avenue for sort of responding to a call, isn't there. It's not manifested in people's daily life, and it goes to that question that I did encounter with a lot of the men, which was, where's the institution going, and am I making a choice here that's going to that I'm going to regret because there's going to be a change in ministry. Over the course of my lifetime. But that goes to your second question, which is a good one also. And that is, I think that with the decline in priests, it will have an effect on the way people practice. I think the way that Catholics have sort of seen their faith or practiced their faith in the last, over the generations will be changed because the many parishes, for example, will go without priests. In many places, and this is already happening, there won't be Sunday Masses. You know, maybe there'll be a Sunday Mass once a month, something like that. And I think what this means is that the priests themselves will become more sacramental. That means that they will be focusing more, not so much on running parishes, perhaps, but on being there for things like baptism and marriages and, of course, the Mass and confessions, etc. So we might see that kind of change.
Yeah, the other one that I find interesting, a possibility, you were talking about the individual who's blind. Maybe, you know, in terms of the selection of the order, maybe an order like the Jesuits or something with that nature might be more satisfying, or I'm not sure.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, and you know, the thing in the book, what I wanted to do was, I had at one point when I was thinking about this topic, I had thought, oh, well, I'll follow an order, you know, a specific religious order. But the good thing about the seminary I followed was that it was it trains diocesan priests, and they trains them from 38 different dioceses across the country. So it gives the reader a cross-section, I guess, of how things are being done across the country. And one of the surprising things to me was how much unity there seemed to be. You hear a lot about lack of unity within the church, I suppose. And I saw quite a bit of unity in terms of the way these men were being trained, that there's a universal quality to that. You're right. People can seek different orders for different, you know.
But from my understanding, that order, in terms of money, is not an issue. In terms of, I think they can have their own money, own inheritance, and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, that's you raise an interesting question. You know, priests themselves, priests do not have to take your normal diocesan priest is not going to take a, you know, what's I guess in popular mind been called the vow of poverty. You know,
right.
They don't have to do that. So you can own property as a priest.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the likelihood is that you probably won't. I mean, a lot of these men had given up their homes. Sold their homes. Jim Heiser, for example, sold his home to pay for a lot of the incidentals that came from life in seminary. And one of the men in the book says to a group of other guys, he goes, "Look, boys, we're not going to get rich doing this." You know, it's just the simple truth, because you're not going to get paid a lot, and you get your room and board taken care of, but that's about it. You know.
Thank you. So,
thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Also, maybe you would talk a little bit here about. A divorced man whose marriage has been annulled may become a priest.
That's right, and that comes as a lot of surprise. It comes as a big surprise to a lot of people and readers. There's also some degree of controversy around that. I suppose some Catholics have told me, well, you know, if the person couldn't keep their promise or their vows once. Why would they be able to keep their vows again, you know, as a priest? And that, I think, is to some extent is sort of a not a completely fair comparison. And in that, for example, Jim Heiser didn't want to be divorced. It was not his choice. It really happened to him. There's no question in the sense of his promise-keeping ability that his promise to his son, in terms of raising him to adulthood, was a very profound promise, you know, and also in terms of raising him to adulthood without any acrimony for his mother, et cetera, and being a good father, that all of these things certainly contributed to his ability, I think, to potentially be a very good priest.
Yeah. Well, that issue of annulment is a controversial one, and we could probably do a whole show.
You sure could.
Just on that.
And I'm totally ill-equipped.
I'm not prepared either. So we've got just a few minutes left, and I've got a couple questions that I want to get in before we run out of time. Where is the institution headed? That is a good question. How are church leaders, church leaders, responding to the shortage of priests? What lies ahead?
You know, I started the book. The idea for the book really started about 6 years ago, and it started when I was actually at the journalism school, and I had just gone. I was at a mass. It was a Saturday evening mass, and I heard some young seminarian get up and say, oh, you know, there's a crisis in vocations. The numbers are down. And at that moment, I thought, you know, what is this story? Would it be a very, I think, potentially dramatic, a profound sort of human story to capture why someone would, an earnest, sincere person, why would they choose this life? That was the seed of it. At that time, though, I thought, surely, if these numbers are so bad, over the next 5-6 years, we're going to see some really sort of kind of aggressive, comprehensive action on the part of kind of the institutional church to address this stuff. And I have to say, I haven't seen any of that, really. And I don't quite know why that is, but every year it seems that, you know, whenever there's a prayer day for vocations or something, you know, the same basic call is going out, although there are not enough priests, but there doesn't seem to be any kind of comprehensive action being taken, you know, and and the numbers are just getting, and they are indeed just getting worse, really.
Yeah. Well, apparently at the grassroots level, though, people are stepping up, and I know that women today are doing a lot of the ministerial work. Mm. They are working as chaplains, serving in hospitals and hospices and prisons, and they are, you know, working in parishes. So that is happening, and that is also, I suppose you could say, that is also changing the face of the Catholic Church at the, you know, where people live.
Yes. Yeah. Well, in fact, what's interesting about that phenomenon, that's, you're absolutely right. In fact, there are female parish administrators who I've met a few who are essentially running the parishes, and then the priest comes in once a month, something like this. Now, what's interesting about that is the men today are being trained for that reality as priests. They you know, one of the things that happens in the book is people, both priests and lay people, mm-hmm. kinds of lay people you're mentioning, come in and talk to the men, they talk to the seminarians about, well, this is what it looks like out there. This is the lay of the land, as it were, in the parishes, and so the guys are going out there knowing that their role, it's not the old role of the kind of clericalism, a clericalistic role where they sort of take command of every aspect of the parish and sort of run it, and it just doesn't happen anymore. There are large, parish councils, and the priest has to work within those, and work with a great number of different people, and use their talents as well. You know, talents that the priest might not have. You know, for balancing the books or keeping the Catholic education program running or whatever.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. It's changing. These men are going in. They're going into a very difficult job, though. It's harder probably than ever because of the numbers, because of the demand. Because at the core of the story, at least in the way I experienced it in the book or discovered in the book, is that the men are asked to do so many things for so many different people and be there at such kind of emotionally powerful moments in people's lives, and then keep it in a way to themselves. Because they have to be there. And that can be extraordinarily profound and draining. You know, tough job.
Yeah.
It can be a very tough job.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask you now about something that is very important in this whole story, and that is the preparation that happens within a seminary, how the seminary prepares its seminarians for priesthood. And you used this term earlier, and now we're only getting back to it here at the very end. I'm sorry about that. The formation. Mm. Can you give us a couple of minutes, just a couple of minutes, about what that is all about?
Sure. The narrative of the collar works actually follows the process of formation. Formation is at the core of seminary, of the seminary experience. And what it is a sort of multifaceted process. It's academic, it's spiritual, it's pastoral, what they call pastoral. It's a process that takes someone from being just maybe they're a very devout person, but it takes that ordinary person and it equips them in such a way, it sort of takes down, it's like a spiritual boot camp kind of process. It takes off their rough edges, it makes them someone who could serve many people, as opposed to, say, just a religiously devout person who is a good person but isn't a priest, isn't someone who has to be there for so many different people. It's, it, it instead obviously teaches them how to say, you learn how to say the Mass, very practical things as well, the baptism, confession, and all that. But it mainly is the focus on turning someone into a much more well-rounded pastor, someone who is capable of handling for the long haul the rigors of celibacy, the rigors of service to a huge and diverse group of people who are going to have lots of different opinions about, what things are all about, really. I mean, and so that formation process happens on a lot of different levels, one of which is as I said, their formation, for example, their formation classes, spiritual formation classes, and small group of men get together with I followed several of them. One was had a priest and then a female professor of, it was one particular case. She had a psychology degree, and they would go through issues like celibacy and sexuality and then various other elements of sort of social concern.
Yeah.
Social justice was another area that they would explore.
Yeah.
And so this is, it's happening over a 5-year period. So, you take a person and it's a nice long period in which they can really figure out and nut out whether they're meant to be doing this work.
Yeah.
That's the heart of formation.
Yeah. There we have to leave it.
Yeah.
We're out of time.
Okay.
Jonathan,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Jonathan Englert has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Collar, A Year of Striving and Faith Inside a Catholic Seminary. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin.
I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn under the weather today, so we brought you an archive edition of the Afternoon Magazine interview. Our thanks to Celeste for all the hard work she does day in and day out. And we're hopeful that she will get well very quickly and heading into the weekend, certainly, that she's able to enjoy that, as you are. Let's take a look at the numbers in Chicago on this Friday afternoon. They finished like this at the Board of Trade, December contract in the wheat pit today. A high of 888 and three quarters, a low at 845 and three quarters. Their settlement price at 867, 2 cents lower. March contract at 911 and three quarters, top bottom at 867 and a half. Settlement price down 2 3/4 at 884. 5.5 in the May futures, 906.5 the high, the low at 862, our settlement price there at $8.80.5, down a penny and a half for the day. July contract 774 the high, the low at 734, settlement price at 762, 15.5 cents higher, and September futures up 15.5. They finished at 761.5, the high at 76, the low at 39 for the September wheat in the soft red pit in Chicago. December contract in the corn pit a penny higher today. 387.5, the settlement price, high price for the day, the low at 378. The settlement price up one at 384.5 in the December corn futures. March contract 405, the high, the low at 395.5. Settlement price at 401.5, up 3/4 in the May futures. A 415.5 top, bottom at 406. And a settlement price at $4.13, finished 1.5 cents higher. July contract 424.25, the high. Low at 414 and 3/4, settlement price at 421, a penny higher for the day. And September futures, 427 and 3/4, the high, the low at 19.5. Settlement price for the SEP corn at 426 and 1/2, up 1 3/4. December contract at 433 top, the bottom at $4.25, settled at 430.5, finished 1/4 higher for the afternoon. March contract in the corn pit for $2,904.38, the high, the low at 31.25, settlement price at $4.36, up 1/4, and the May futures at 440.5, top, bottom at 34.5, settlement price at $4.40. They finished 0.75 cents higher. December oat futures now 269.5, the high, the low at 62.75, their settlement price at $2.69.5. The December oat futures a penny and a half higher. The March contract had down 0.5 cent at $2.83 a bushel. From the soy complex this afternoon, January beans $10.80, the settlement price. They finished 18 cents lower for the day, the high at 10.97 3/4, the low at 10.75 1/2. Settlement price in the nearby Jans at $10.80, once again down 18 cents. March contract from the bean pit, 11.14 the high, the low at 10.92. Settlement price at 10.97.5, down 17.5 in the May futures, 16.25 lower, $11.06. The settlement price, the high at 21.5, the low at $11.15. July contract in the bean pit, 11.23 3/4, the high, the low at 11.03. Settlement price down 18 cents at 11.07. And September futures, a 10.60 top, bottom at 50. Settlement price at the bottom of that range, down 12 cents at $10.50 for the September futures next year. November 2008 at 10.23 top, bottom at 10.02, settled at 10.10 3/4, down 11.25 for the afternoon. January futures, a dime lower, 10.25 the high, the low at 10.13. January 2009 soybeans, $10.16 the settlement price, down 10 for the day. December bean meal futures at 292.20, or rather at 292.80 for the high today. The low at 286.50, settlement price at 288.30, down $3.80 for the December bean meal. January futures down $2.60 at $293. December bean oil settled at 45.64, down 56 with a high of 46.29 and a low at 45.32. And the January contract for the soybean oil in Chicago at 46.10 finished 54 lower on the afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Actually, you're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. The Closing Market Report will come up in just a few minutes. We'll start that at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time this afternoon.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
The numbers now from the Mercantile Exchange, part of the CME Group. December live cattle futures for the livestock today. A high price at 94.57.5, the low at 93.75, settlement price at 93.85, 72.5 cents lower. February futures down 87.5 cents, with a settlement price at $95.77.5 a hundredweight. The high at 96.70, the low at 95.65. April futures 97.70, the high, the low at 96.95. Settlement price at 97.10.